criminal. So here we have several different groups, different individuals, all vying for power. You've got the religious authority of the Sanhedrin, religious authority. You have the civil authority of Pilate and the soldiers, and you have the people. You've got the crowd, the group that both the religious and political authorities fear, right? They want to appease the crowd. And because fear of man is making all the decisions in the religious courts and in the civil courts, injustice reigns. Because fear of man is making all the decisions, injustice reigns. Rule by popular demand reigns. Justice by crowd mentality and mob rule reigns. So you have three groups. You also have three instances in the text, verse 1, 16, and 20, of Jesus being led somewhere. He is led by the Sanhedrin to Pilate. He is led by the soldiers to the palace. He is led by the soldiers to the cross. Here is the gentle, humble lamb of Isaiah 53 who is led to slaughter. But in the midst of all these power struggles, religious courts, civil authorities, crowds baying for blood, in the midst of the power struggles, we see a Christ who possesses the simple and quiet authority of the true humble king, who knows the outcome, and a powerful king who is in control of the outcome. He has no need to prove anything to these men. Here we see what true power looks like and where true power and authority lies. Acts 2:23 will confirm for us that although Jesus is led or delivered up three times by these men, Peter tells us that, verse 23 of Acts 2, this Jesus who was delivered up according to the definite plan and foreknowledge of God, you crucified and killed by the hands of lawless men. This was all God's plan. God was in control. There was no shock, no horror. It was Jesus who had to give, if you remember, the Sanhedrin, the claim by which they could accuse him of blasphemy. They couldn't get it out of him. They couldn't get their stories to line up. The accusations didn't match. It was Jesus who gave them the words they needed to accuse him and condemn him. He was in control, start to finish and all the way through. They led him, but ultimately he was the one leading and controlling and foreordaining and fulfilling and ensuring the salvation of many. He was delivered up, yes, but he was delivered up to deliver us. So as we walk through the text, we see in verse 1 that, as I said, the authority of the religious leaders had limits. They could not kill Jesus themselves. The Roman government reserved that power of capital punishment. So having already condemned him as deserving death in Mark 14:64, they now take that verdict from the Jewish court. They take that verdict and they take it to the political powers. They take it to Pilate, the only one who had the power there to wield the sword. God's own people reject and condemn the cornerstone, right? Condemn and reject Jesus to death and deliver him over to the Gentiles for punishment and judgment. This is exactly what Jesus had said would happen in Mark 10:33. Jesus appears before Pilate, and in verse 2, Pilate asks him, "Are you the king of the Jews?" The Greek is more like, "You are the king of the Jews." It's more like a statement that has an inflection, if you catch my drift. The charge, though, is no longer blasphemy. That's the charge that the Sanhedrin came to. This man has blasphemed. But that's not the charge now. The charge is treason. The charge is a political one, not a religious one. Are you the king of the Jews? Are you a pretender? Are you trying to get power here politically? Jesus replies somewhat cryptically, "You have said so." You have said so. Now, blasphemy wasn't a capital offense. Remember that for the Romans, so there could have been no death penalty just for blasphemy. There was the Roman state didn't care if you blasphemed against the God they didn't worship. But treason was. And so by couching the accusation in these terms, it's possible to get a capital punishment verdict. Casting the accusation in this light, the Sanhedrin could get Pilate to do this. But in Jesus' response, "You have said so," we can see that Pilate is asking the right question, but he doesn't understand the question he's asking, right? Jesus, in his response, reveals to us that Pilate's asking the right question, but he doesn't really understand the question he's asking. On one level, the charge is false. In Pilate's understanding of his question, the charge is false. "Are you the king of the Jews?" Jesus is saying, not in the way you think I'm the king of the Jews. I'm not here to sit on a physical throne in physical Jerusalem only, right? That's not what I'm here to do. I'm here to do a lot more than that. We know the end of the story. We know what it is. He hasn't come as some rebel leader on a mission to foment insurrection, an uprising. He wasn't that type of king. But on another level, Pilate's question is emphatically true and a good one. Are you the king of the Jews? Absolutely. And everyone else. And everywhere else. And over everything else. I'm not just king of Jews only. I'm king of the whole world, the whole cosmos. Nothing was made without me, we know, because we have the rest of our New Testament. Jesus then is king of the Jews, but not just the Jews. He's king of all creation. And in saying, "You have said so," I think it's almost like he's saying, "You are right, but you don't know how right you are." Or, "You would do well to consider the question you've just asked me. You have said so. Keep thinking on it, Pilate." So we see here a fundamental principle that Christians have to reclaim in our time and age. All religious claims are political, and all political claims are religious. Okay, all religious claims are political, and all political claims are religious. To claim religious allegiance to a king is a political claim. To claim a religious allegiance is to claim something about political structures. To claim that Christ is king is to make a claim that all other kings and rulers, all other Pilates, are subject to his kingship. A claim about a religious claim is a claim about power, about how people should govern, about how people should be governed, what justice and equity looks like, how society should run, who should be obeyed, whose word should be obeyed. In the time when Mark's gospel would have first been read, one of the political religious claims was that Caesar is Lord. Christians were to bow to Caesar. Faithful Christians refused to do this, and they were persecuted for it. In our day, the same thing happens all over the world, especially in dictatorships. Ultimate loyalty must be given to the supreme leader. But let's not just point the finger over there and think it's just a problem for the dictatorships. It's also a problem for the democracies. It's a problem for our culture as well. In our Western democratic culture, in our nation, the political authorities claim that the nation should be secular, that the public square should be secular. Yes, religion should be protected, but really it should be private. Anything other than that is breaching the peace, right? Claim to have religiously secular, neutral public square. But note that that's not just a political claim, is it? It's a religious claim. Why is it a religious one? Because it's saying your Christ is not king here. Your Christ is not king in the public square. Your Christ is not king over parliament or over the law courts or over the schools. And so when we make what on the surface seems to be a religious claim, Christ is king, Christ is Lord, what we are inescapably doing is making an equally political claim that he is actually king, not just of your heart, although he is, but he's also king of this land. Like the physical stuff you walk on, the bricks and mortar you live in, the petrol that you put in your car, it's all from him. It's all from his abundance. It's all from his creative hand. He is king of the stuff as well as the stuff that's hard to articulate, the internals, the spiritual. He is king of all of it. He's not just king of your heart. He's king of this land and he's king of the people. They might deny it, but it's no less true for that. So to claim neutrality is to claim that Christ is not king. A political claim becomes a religious claim. You see how it works? And so if God is not over government, government becomes God. There has to be a source and a standard. There has to be someone or somewhere from which we get truth, goodness, beauty, and the standards for those things. There has to be a standard. Okay? And so by removing God or trying to remove God from the public square, what happens is the standard becomes whoever is in power at that point. And guess what? That's always the people. Because the politicians, the corrupt religious leaders, the fear of the people leads to the policy decisions. So don't be fooled when people tell you to keep your religion out of politics, right? Can't be done. That's an impossible thing to try and do. You cannot keep religion out of politics. To attempt to do so is to engage in the futility of trying to make Christ king over your heart, whatever that means, without being king of anything outside of it. All right? Christ's kingship is not just an idea in your head. It's not just a self-help technique. It's not an emotional support mechanism. It's a claim for Christ to have actual authority over everything. In verse 3, Jesus is accused of many things. The chief priests try and lay it on thick before Pilate. In chapter 14, they couldn't get their testimonies to agree. So now it's just pile on as much accusation as possible. Let's hope something sticks. Luke's gospel gives us more information about it. All the charges have become politicized so that Pilate might get to some sort of verdict. Pilate speaks again to Jesus in verse 4 about these extra charges. Have you no answer to make? See how many charges they are bringing against you. But once again, Jesus remains silent, giving no further answer. And Pilate is amazed. Perhaps Pilate sees how thin the charges are and sees how easy it would be for Jesus to speak up and defend himself and get off scot-free. One scholar claims that in the context of Roman law, silence in the face of accusation implies a covert admission of guilt. Right? So that the scholars say in Roman courts, if you were silent before the charges, it was as good as saying I'm guilty. And so you've got these thin accusations. Pilate knows, we see it later, that it's for envy that these charges have been brought. These envies wouldn't stand if the court was fair. All Jesus has to do is defend himself. And maybe that's why Pilate's amazed. All he has to do is say it's not true. And he'd save his life. But of course it is true. But not in the way Pilate thinks it's true. So this is not the kind of silence that comes to the coward when confronted. You know, we see now TV programs, police programs, the criminal remains silent in case they incriminate themselves, right? It's reversed now, okay? But here, silence implied guilt. So this is not the silence taken up by the coward who doesn't want to incriminate himself. This is the kind of silence that witnesses. This is the kind of silence that remains silence when excuses could be given, when compromise could be taken. When speech would be compromised, silence is faithfulness. In verse 6, we're told that it was customary for the authorities to release a prisoner at the feast. In verse 7, we're told there was a particular candidate, Barabbas, a man who had taken part in an actual political uprising. Right, this is what you have to realize is in the text. Right? Barabbas had murdered someone in the insurrection. There had been here is an actual treasonous traitor, an actual enemy of the state called Barabbas, contrasted with someone who is called the king of the Jews, but is not an enemy of the state. Okay? Wrongly accused, rightly accused. Barabbas is rightly accused of insurrection and treason. But in verse 8, the crowd start asking Pilate to release the prisoner, as they usually did at the feast. In verse 9, perhaps assuming Jesus to be the obvious choice, Pilate asks him, "Do you want me to release for you the king of the Jews?" Verse 10 tells us that Pilate knew that the Sanhedrin were envious of Jesus, and that's why they were trying to get him executed. So Pilate sees innocent Jesus on trumped up charges and a guilty man, an actual insurrectionist, who wants to, and Pilate wants to probably make sure the murderer stays locked up and the innocent guy goes loose, right? As a short point of application, notice that Pilate identifies rightly that envy is one of the motivating factors for the injustice that happens. Envy is one of the motivating factors in almost every injustice that happens today. Okay? Almost every injustice has envy at the bottom of it. One writer defines envy this way, that envy is grief or anger caused by another's success. Envy is grief or anger caused by another's success. And before you look at other examples out there, but what I want us to do today is think about that reaction in your own heart. That reaction in your own heart. It's easy to do. Even very, very mature Christians can succumb to envy, okay? When a friend or a sibling, you know, children in the room, I don't know if you've ever had, you know, one of your siblings got an awesome birthday present and you have to wait 6 months to your birthday. And you're like, why can't I have a birthday when they have a birthday? But then when you have a birthday, it flips. Right? Whatever it might be. And you can get envious, can't you, of what your siblings got or, you know, grown-ups in the room. Because we don't get envious about things like that, do we? But grown-ups in the room, you know, work, the other colleague gets the promotion, gets the opportunity, gets the responsibility you had your eye on. In church, that, you know, that person seems to be given opportunity or trusted with things. Whatever it might be, you know, the family down the road just got a new car. And yours is hanging on by the skin of its you know, inner tire tube, right? It's ready to go. You know, the family down the road had the 5-star luxury all expenses trip to wherever, and you went to Butlins again, right? Nothing wrong with Butlins, but you know what I mean. And how, you see how easily envy can come into our hearts, come into our lives. How do we respond to envy? Envy is a deadly sin because it creates grief and anger over God's blessings in someone else's life. Every good gift we have comes from God. To be envious of something and angry about something someone else has got is to be angry at God's choice to bless them. Envy puts you at enmity with God, just like every sin does. But envy ultimately breeds ingratitude for God's gifts in your life. An entitlement because you want more of God's gifts in your life and you can't be content. Envy leads ultimately to more and more damage, more and more brokenness. And so we need to be tuned in to envy, tuned in to when we feel grief or anger at someone else's success. And we need to recognize it, repent of it, confess it, and shut down envy in our lives in those moments. In verse 11, continuing through the text, in verse 11, contrary to everything that makes sense, the crowd asks Pilate to release Barabbas. To release the actual traitor, the actual committer of treason. This is because the chief priests have stirred up the crowd. It's all part of the conspiracy. They've planted people in the crowd, just like they rounded up the false witnesses in the trial during the night. They have put plants in the crowd. And then you know how crowds work. It's contagious. Folly is contagious. It spreads like wildfire. The crowd have been told who to vote for. And the great irony is this. Here's the great irony. Jesus, in chapter 13, had just predicted the destruction of the temple and Jerusalem. Go back a few weeks, we talked about that. Jesus had just predicted the destruction of the temple and Jerusalem. That fact was obscure to them, but it's clear to us. We know how it plays out. But as one commentator puts it, the same accusers telling Pilate that Jesus must be executed for claiming to be king are siding with a murderous revolutionary against Rome. Right now, pay attention to this, it's important. In other words, on the one hand, you've got the Jewish authorities under the heel of Rome. And on the other hand, you have Rome, who are nervous of a Jewish uprising. It's the Passover feast. There'll be tens of thousands extra men in Jerusalem. Okay, an uprising is a very real threat. That's the context. And in all of this context, you have the same Jewish authorities asking Rome to release an actual traitor, an actual insurrectionist, in order to protect the Sanhedrin's grip on the Jewish population by killing the innocent man Jesus. All right. If that's complicated, what you have is the Jewish authorities calling down judgment on themselves. Pilate, the Roman, you really want me to release the insurrectionist, the one who wants to overthrow Rome? Is that what you want? We know where that leads. AD 70, Rome comes in, destroys the temple, destroys Jerusalem, as Jesus prophesied, not one stone remaining on another. They're calling down their own judgment. Going back to envy for a moment, this is how envy works. When you act out of envy, when you act out of insecurity, you create the conditions that you're fearful of. You get the stuff you were afraid of in the first place. You create the conditions, the environment in which your fears come true. That's what envy does. The Sanhedrin were afraid of losing power to Jesus, so they end up doing something that would make Rome even more skeptical of their leadership. They ask Rome to release an actual traitor and revolutionary. In asking for Barabbas to be released, Jerusalem is adding another nail in its own coffin. It was further ensuring, according to God's definite plan, its own judgment and destruction. And as I said, this is how envy works. How does this work in our lives? Are you afraid that people might not like you, your personality, the way you act, and so on, and then you start changing your behavior to please people? And have you noticed they start sort of edging away from you? You know, this guy's acting strange. Envy or insecurity. It creates the conditions you're fearful of. Are you afraid of losing control? So what do you do when you're afraid of losing control? Tighten your grip. And what happens? You squeeze it all out. And people start, again, walking away. I don't want to be associated with that kind of control freak. And you lose the control you didn't have in the first place. Afraid of sickness. You're paranoid about sickness. It causes fear and it causes stress. It causes further anxiety that has physiological impact on our physical bodies. Are you afraid of what might happen in your kids' futures? Right? What happened? You know, will they like me when they grow up? Will they follow Christ when they grow up? Will they be good people when they grow up? And then what you do is you appease their every desire to keep them happy. And it wrecks their future. Right? You see how envy and insecurity creates the conditions of which we're fearful. Envy and insecurity caused the Jews to have Pilate condemn the man who shouldn't have died and to release the man who was an actual insurrectionist. And of course, Rome in 40 more years would come in and destroy Jerusalem. Pilate asks the crowd in verse 12, what then should be done about Jesus? They respond in verse 13, crucify him. Pilate asks in verse 14, what for? What evil has he done? But instead of responding with a reason, they shout all the more, crucify him. Now, Pilate up to this point has probably seemed to you like a relatively just and fair man, at least a relatively common sense man. But now he's revealed just to be another politician, another pragmatist, right? In verse 15, we see that he fears the crowd just as much as the Sanhedrin feared the crowd. He wanted to satisfy the crowd, to please them. So he proceeds to do the unjust thing, to release Barabbas and to scourge Jesus. And as the creed says, he suffered under Pontius Pilate. Pilate was not innocent here. He had responsibility. He did the wrong thing. He scourges Jesus, delivers him up to be crucified. Mark doesn't go into detail like the other gospel writers do. Mark keeps to the basics. He's delivered up to the Gentiles, as predicted in Mark 10:33, and he's scourged in fulfillment of Mark 10:34. So here we see a corrupt political and a corrupt religious order. Corrupt because it doesn't recognize God and his law. Any government like that, be it civil, the political government, the civil government, be it familial, the family government, be it ecclesiastical, the government in the church, any government that is corrupt because it doesn't recognize God and his law will be in the habit of calling evil good and good evil. It will be in the habit of appointing pro-choice archbishops. Pro-choice because I'm being kind. Yeah? Archbishops who are happy with killing babies in the womb. Okay? This is a ecclesiastical form of government that has abandoned the ultimate law of God and will, at some point, is already receiving the rebuke judgment of God. Any government like that will be in the habit of condemning the innocent and freeing the guilty. You see, fallen man doesn't want justice. Fallen man doesn't want justice. Pilate seeks to rule, but he ends up being governed by the crowd. Jesus, ever accompanied by a crowd, served them, but never once allowed them to rule him. In verses 16 to 20, closing this passage, we hear about the soldiers who lead Jesus away. There's an entire battalion present. Such was the fear of an uprising. And the soldiers, they clothed Jesus in a purple cloak and a crown of thorns, which is a parody, basically, of how they would dress the Roman emperor. He has been mocked by the Sanhedrin in the night. He is mocked by the soldiers now. Soon he will be mocked in his crucifixion. And this is all fulfillment of prophecy. And just know this. Just know this. Whatever mockery you endure for your faith, it's nothing like what he endured. Right? Because you're going to get mocked by other people, other human beings. But Jesus, potter, mocked by clay. Creator, mocked by dust. Atoms that he holds together by his word of power. Mocking, spitting on him, scourging him. And just like Pilate had unwittingly affirmed Jesus as king of the Jews, you're the king of the Jews, here the soldiers unwittingly acknowledge the same fact. Although they do it in mockery, they bow before him. They don't realize what they're doing. But just like one day every knee will bow, regardless of your free will, here the soldiers bow to the Lord. Humanity cannot help but bear witness to its creator, even in mockery. Their faux emperor worship unwittingly acknowledges a true thing, that he is Lord of all. And one day, their knees too will bow again, but not in mockery, in fear and wonder. At the end of verse 20, they remove the cloak and put him in his own clothes. They lead him out to be crucified. He was delivered up to be crucified, not just because of a wicked, envious religious group, not just because of a pragmatic, weak political group. He was delivered up according to God's own definite plan of salvation. Definite because it definitely was always going to happen. Predefined, predetermined, foreordained, absolutely sure. Nothing could change God's plan. Whilst being led, he is leading. Whilst being delivered up, he is delivering us. So what are we to take from all this? Well, we've spoken about the dangers of envy. We've spoken about the folly of trying to claim that Christ is only king in some sort of private religious sense. Every religious claim is political. Every political claim is religious. Christ is king. And it's not our job just to get more people acknowledging that in their hearts. Right? That's a really important step. And you don't get the rest if you don't get that. But that's not where it ends. We're not just trying to get people to make a sort of intellectual, emotional decision. We're proclaiming Christ's kingship over all creation and calling all creation to bow in worship and honor and reverence and obedience to him. Peoples whose hearts have been changed will change the world around them, which includes the public square. It includes parliament and universities and schools and courts and families and workplaces and churches. He is king of all of it. Christ is king. Make no mistake, he is not a mere figurehead. His kingship is not just a religious idea. He is actually king over an actual creation, including this earth, including every other king, every president, including your workplace, including your home. He is king. It is all his. We need to recover an understanding of the fact that Jesus really is the king. Lots of people say it, just like Pilate, but don't realize what it is they're saying. Lots of people claim it to be true, but don't realize what the claim entails. Perhaps one question then we might ask as we close is where do we respond like the soldiers in a sort of mockery of worship? Where do we respond like the soldiers in a parody of honor and praise? Calvin said, put it like this, you know, where do we crown Christ in mockery? Where do we crown Christ? Where do we give lip service to his kingship, but our worship is flippant, irreverent, or non-existent? Where do we give lip service to worship and make it all about us? The song I like to sing, or the way I like to do things, or the feeling it gives me. Where do we profess Christ as king, but live as if that's not true? Where are we guilty like the soldiers of saying the right things about Jesus, but living in a way that treats him as if he were a pretender to the throne? Really? In reality, we want to sit on the throne. The human heart hates to give up power, hates to give up authority. We want to call the shots. So where do we need to repent of that? Furthermore, we can all identify with different people from the text at different times, with the religious leaders who will not be corrected, with the political class who are driven by fear, with the crowd baying for blood, getting caught up in the hysteria of what's happening in the world around them. Or we can identify with Jesus who suffers. 1 Peter chapter 2, 21 to 23. For to this you have been called, because Christ also suffered for you, leaving you an example so that you might follow in his steps. He committed no sin, neither was deceit found in his mouth. When he was reviled, he did not revile in return. When he suffered, he did not threaten, but continued entrusting himself to him who judges justly. This is the example to follow. This is a lesson in how we as Christians are to suffer with a quiet dignity. Christians are to suffer with a quiet dignity. We are not to fall into the trap of complaining about how persecuted we are, to complain about how oppressed we are, to complaining about how unfair it all is. That's just woke from another perspective. That's just creating a new victim class. I'm a poor, victimized Christian. No, you have been crucified with Christ. And now it's no longer you, but Christ who lives in you. To suffer for him is the greatest privilege that you can experience in this life. Because if you suffer with him, guess what? You also reign with him. So don't go woke, Christian. I mean, forget the nonsense woke stuff. Don't go woke and just be a victim. All this persecution, how hard it is to be a Christian. Be like Christ, who suffered with dignity, who suffered with a quiet strength and a humility, who was able to look power in the face and stay absolutely assured that his Father was in utter, absolute, definite control of every detail. There's Acts 2:23 again. Jesus was delivered up according to the definite plan and foreknowledge of God. Delivered up not by human hands, as if human beings could lay a finger on God, but by his own eternal will. When conspiracies rage, when persecution comes, when injustice flows, when trials of various sorts appear, count it all joy, dear brothers. Because nothing happens outside of God's definite plan and foreknowledge, and he brings about great good for those whom he loves. Trust him to rule and reign. Trust him to bring about salvation and rescue from ruins and brokenness. Let's pray.